This is Audible.
Recorded books and one-click digital present Bird by Bird, Some Instructions on Writing and Life by Anne Lamott, narrated by Susan Bennett and directed by Ezra Tenenbaum. One-click digital provides free audiobook downloads in partnership with thousands of public libraries. To see if OneClick Digital's extensive catalog is available to you, visit your library's website. And now, Bird by Bird.
Introduction. I grew up around a father and a mother who read every chance they got, who took us to the library every Thursday night to load up on books for the coming week. Most nights after dinner, my father stretched out on the couch to read, while my mother sat with her book in the easy chair, and the three of us kids each retired to our own private reading stations. Our house was very quiet after dinner, unless, that is, some of my father's writer friends were over. My father was a writer, as were most of the men with whom he hung out. They were not the quietest people on earth, but they were mostly very masculine and kind. Usually in the afternoons, when that day's work was done, they hung out at the no-name bar in Sausalito. But sometimes they came to our house for drinks and ended up staying for supper. I loved them. But every so often one of them would pass out at the dinner table. I was an anxious child to begin with, and I found this unnerving. Every morning, no matter how late he had been up, my father rose at 5:30, went to his study, wrote for a couple of hours, made us all breakfast, read the paper with my mother, and then went back to work for the rest of the morning. Many years passed before I realized that he did this by choice, for a living, and that he was not unemployed or mentally ill. I wanted him to have a regular job where he put on a necktie and went off somewhere with the other fathers and sat in a little office and smoked, but the idea of spending entire days in someone else's office doing someone else's work did not suit my father's soul. I think it would have killed him. He did end up dying rather early, in his mid-50s, but at least he had lived on his own terms. So, I grew up around this man who sat at his desk in the study all day and wrote books and articles about the places and people he had seen and known. He read a lot of poetry. Sometimes he traveled. He could go any place he wanted with a sense of purpose. One of the gifts of being a writer is that it gives you an excuse to do things, to go places and explore. Another is that writing motivates you to look closely at life as it lurches by and tramps around. Writing taught my father to pay attention. My father, in turn, taught other people to pay attention and then to write down their thoughts and observations. His students were the prisoners at San Quentin who took part in the creative writing program. But he taught me, too, mostly by example. He taught the prisoners and me to put a little bit down on paper every day and to read all the great books and plays we could get our hands on. He taught us to read poetry. He taught us to be bold and original and to let ourselves make mistakes. And that Thurber was right when he said, you might as well fall flat on your face as lean over too far backwards. But while he helped the prisoners and me to discover that we had a lot of feelings and observations and memories and dreams and God knows opinions we wanted to share, we all ended up just the tiniest bit resentful when we found the one fly in the ointment, that at some point we had to actually sit down and write. I believe writing was easier for me than for the prisoners because I was still a child. But I always found it hard. I started writing when I was 7 or 8. I was very shy and strange-looking, loved reading above everything else, weighed about 40 pounds at the time, and was so tense that I walked around with my shoulders up to my ears like Richard Nixon. I saw a home movie once of a birthday party I went to in the first grade, with all these cute little boys and girls playing together, like puppies, and all of a sudden I scuttled across the screen like Prufrock's crab. I was very clearly the one who was going to grow up to be a serial killer, or keep dozens and dozens of cats. Instead, I got funny. I got funny because boys, older boys I didn't even know, would ride by on their bicycles and taunt me about my weird looks. Each time felt like a drive-by shooting. I think this is why I walked like Nixon. I think I was trying to plug my ears with my shoulders, but they wouldn't quite reach. So, first, I got funny, and then I started to write, although I did not always write funny things. The first poem I wrote that got any attention was about John Glenn. The first stanza went, "Colonel John Glenn went up to heaven in his spaceship, Friendship 7. There were many, many verses. It was like one of the old English ballads my mother taught us to sing while she played the piano. Each song had 30 or 40 verses, which would leave my male relatives flattened to our couches and armchairs as if by centrifugal force, staring unblinking up at the ceiling. The teacher read the John Glenn poem to my second grade class. It was a great moment. The other children looked at me as though I had learned to drive. It turned out that the teacher had submitted the poem to a California State Schools competition, and it had won some sort of award. It appeared in a mimeographed collection. I understood immediately the thrill of seeing oneself in print. It provides some sort of primal verification. You are in print, therefore you exist. Who knows what this urge is all about, to appear somewhere outside yourself, instead of feeling stuck inside your muddled but stroboscopic mind, peering out like a little undersea animal, a spiny blenny, for instance, from inside your tiny cave. Seeing yourself in print is such an amazing concept. You can get so much attention without having to actually show up somewhere. While others who have something to say or who want to be effectual, like musicians or baseball players or politicians, have to get out there in front of people, writers, who tend to be shy, get to stay home and still be public. There are many obvious advantages to this. You don't have to dress up, for instance, and you can't hear them boo you right away. Sometimes I got to sit on the floor of my father's study and write my poems while he sat at his desk writing his books. Every couple of years, another book of his was published. Books were revered in our house, and great writers admired above everyone else. Special books got displayed prominently, on the coffee table, on the radio, on the back of the John. I grew up reading the blurbs on dust jackets and the reviews of my father's books in the papers. All of this made me start wanting to be a writer when I grew up. To be artistic, a free spirit, and yet also to be the rare working-class person in charge of her own life. Still, I worried that there was never quite enough money at our house. I worried that my father was going to turn into a bum like some of his writer friends. I remember when I was 10 years old, my father published a piece in a magazine that mentioned his having spent an afternoon on a porch at Stinson Beach with a bunch of other writers, and that they had all been drinking lots of red wine and smoking marijuana. No one smoked marijuana in those days except jazz musicians, and they were all also heroin addicts. Nice white middle-class fathers were not supposed to be smoking marijuana. They were supposed to be sailing or playing tennis. My friends' fathers, who were teachers and doctors and firefighters and lawyers, did not smoke marijuana. Most of them didn't even drink, and they certainly did not have colleagues who came over and passed out at the table over the tuna casserole. Reading my father's article, I could only imagine that the world was breaking down, that the next time I burst into my dad's study to show him my report card, he'd be crouched under the desk with one of my mother's nylon stockings knotted around his upper arm, looking up at me like a cornered wolf. I felt that this was going to be a problem. I was sure that we would be ostracized in our community. All I ever wanted was to belong, to wear that hat of belonging. In 7th and 8th grades, I still weighed about 40 pounds. I was 12 years old and had been getting teased about my strange looks for most of my life. This is a difficult country to look too different in, the United States of advertising, as Paul Krassner puts it. And if you are too skinny or too tall or dark or weird or short or frizzy or homely or poor or nearsighted, you get crucified. I did. But I was funny. So the popular kids let me hang out with them, go to their parties, and watch them neck with each other. This, as you might imagine, did not help my self-esteem a great deal. I thought I was a total loser. But one day, I took a notebook and a pen when I went to Bolinas Beach with my father, who was not, as far as I could tell, shooting drugs yet. With the writer's equivalent of a canvas and brush, I wrote a description of what I saw. I walked to the lip of the water and let the foamy tongue of the rushing liquid lick my toes. A sand crab burrowed a hole a few inches from my foot and then disappeared into the damp sand. I will spare you the rest. It goes on for quite a while. My father convinced me to show it to a teacher, and it ended up being included in a real textbook. This deeply impressed my teachers and parents and a few kids, even some of the popular kids, who invited me to more parties so I could watch them all make out even more frequently. One of the popular girls came home with me after school one day to spend the night. We found my parents rejoicing over the arrival of my dad's new novel, the first copy off the press. We were all so thrilled and proud, and this girl seemed to think I had the coolest possible father, a writer. Her father sold cars. We went out to dinner, where we all toasted one another. Things in the family just couldn't have been better, and here was a friend to witness it. Then, that night, before we went to sleep, I picked up the new novel and began to read the first page to my friend. We were lying side by side in sleeping bags on my floor. The first page turned out to be about a man and a woman in bed together, having sex. The man was playing with the woman's nipple. I began to giggle with mounting hysteria. "Oh, this is great," I thought, beaming jocularly at my friend. I covered my mouth with one hand like a blushing Charlie Chaplin and pantomimed that I was about to toss that silly book over my shoulder. "This is wonderful," I thought, throwing back my head to laugh jovially. "My father writes pornography." In the dark, I glowed like a light bulb with shame. You could have read by me. I never mentioned the book to my father, although over the next couple of years I went through it late at night, looking for more sexy parts, of which there were a number. It was very confusing. It made me feel very scared and sad. Then a strange thing happened. My father wrote an article for a magazine called A Lousy Place to Raise Kids, and it was about Marin County, and specifically the community where we lived, which is as beautiful a place as one can imagine. Yet the people on our peninsula were second only to the Native Americans in the slums of Oakland in the rate of alcoholism, and the drug abuse among teenagers was, as my father wrote, soul-chilling. And there was rampant divorce and mental breakdown and wayward sexual behavior. My father wrote disparagingly about the men in the community, their values and materialistic frenzy, and about their wives, quote, "these estimable women, the wives of doctors, architects, and lawyers, in tennis dresses and cotton frocks, tanned and well-preserved, wandering the aisles of our supermarkets with glints of madness in their eyes." No one in our town came off looking great. "This is the great tragedy of California," he wrote in the last paragraph. "For a life oriented to leisure is in the end a life oriented to death, the greatest leisure of all." There was just one problem. I was an avid tennis player. The tennis ladies were my friends. I practiced every afternoon at the same tennis club as they. I sat with them on the weekends and waited for the men, who had priority, to be done so we could get on the courts. And now my father had made them look like decadent zombies. I thought we were ruined. But my older brother came home from school that week with a photocopy of my father's article that his teachers in both social studies and English had passed out to their classes. John was a hero to his classmates. There was an enormous response in the community. In the next few months, I was snubbed by a number of men and women at the tennis club, but at the same time, people stopped my father on the street when we were walking together and took his hand in both of theirs, as if he had done them some personal favor. Later that summer, I came to know how they felt when I read Catcher in the Rye for the first time and knew what it was like to have someone speak for me, to close a book with a sense of both triumph and relief. One lonely, isolated social animal finally making contact. I started writing a lot in high school. Journals, impassioned anti-war pieces, parodies of the writers I loved. And I began to notice something important. The other kids always wanted me to tell them stories of what had happened, even or especially when they had been there. Parties that got away from us. Blow-ups in the classroom or on the schoolyard, scenes involving their parents that we had witnessed. I could make the story happen. I could make it vivid and funny, and even exaggerate some of it so that the event became almost mythical, and the people involved seemed larger and there was a sense of larger significance. of meaning. I'm sure my father was the person on whom his friends relied to tell their stories in school and college. I know for sure that he was later in the town where he was raising his children. He could take major events or small episodes from daily life and shade or exaggerate things in such a way as to capture their shape and substance, capture what life felt like in the society in which he and his friends lived and worked and bred. People looked to him to put into words what was going on. I suspect that he was a child who thought differently than his peers, who may have had serious conversations with grown-ups, who, as a young person like me, accepted being alone quite a lot. I think that this sort of person often becomes either a writer or a career criminal. Throughout my childhood, I believed that what I thought about was different from what other kids thought about. It was not necessarily more profound, but there was a struggle going on inside me to find some sort of creative or spiritual or aesthetic way of seeing the world and organizing it in my head. I read more than other kids. I luxuriated in books. Books were my refuge. I sat in corners with my little finger hooked over my bottom lip, reading in a trance, lost in the places and times to which books took me. And there was a moment during my junior year in high school when I began to believe that I could do what other writers were doing. I came to believe that I might be able to put a pencil in my hand and make something magical happen. Then I wrote some terrible, terrible stories. In college, the whole world opened up, and the books and poets being taught in my English and philosophy classes gave me the feeling for the first time in my life that there was hope. Hope that I might find my place in a community. I felt that in my strange new friends and in certain new books, I was meeting my other half. Some people wanted to get rich or famous, but my friends and I wanted to get real. We wanted to get deep. Also, I suppose, we wanted to get laid. I devoured books like a person taking vitamins, afraid that otherwise I would remain this gelatinous narcissist with no possibility of ever becoming thoughtful, of ever being taken seriously. I became a socialist for 5 weeks. Then the bus ride to my socialist meetings wore me out. I was drawn to oddballs, ethnic people, theater people, poets, radicals, gays, and lesbians. And somehow they all helped me become some of those things I wanted so desperately to become, political, intellectual, artistic. My friends turned me on to Kierkegaard, Beckett, Doris Lessing. I swooned with the excitement and nourishment of it all. I remember reading C.S. Lewis for the first time, surprised by joy, and how, looking inside himself, he found a zoo of lusts, a bedlam of ambitions, a nursery of fears, a harem of fondled hatreds. I felt elated and absolved. I had thought that the people one admired, the kind, smart people of the world, were not like that on the inside, were different from me, and say, Toulouse-Lautrec. I started writing sophomoric articles for the college paper. Luckily, I was a sophomore. I was incompetent in all college ways except one. I got the best grades in English. I wrote the best papers. But I was ambitious. I wanted to be recognized on a larger scale, so I dropped out at 19 to become a famous writer. I moved back to San Francisco and became a famous Kelly girl instead. I was famous for my incompetence and weepiness. I wept with boredom and disbelief. Then I landed a job as a clerk typist at a huge engineering and construction firm in the city, in the Nuclear Quality Assurance Department, where I labored under a tsunami wave of triplicate forms and memos. It was very upsetting. It was also so boring that it made my eyes feel ringed with dark circles, like lurch. I finally figured out that most of this paperwork could be tossed without there being any real, well, fallout, and this freed me up to write short stories instead. "Do it every day for a while," my father kept saying. "Do it as you would do scales on the piano. Do it by prearrangement with yourself. Do it as a debt of honor. And make a commitment to finishing things." So, in addition to writing furtively at the office, I wrote every night for an hour or more, often in coffee houses with a notepad and my pen, drinking great quantities of wine because this is what writers do. This is what my father and all his friends did. It worked for them, although there was now a new and disturbing trend. They had started committing suicide. This was very painful for my father, of course, but we both kept writing. I eventually moved out to Bolinas, where my father and younger brother had moved the year before when my parents split up. I began to teach tennis and clean houses for a living. Every day for a couple of years, I wrote little snippets and vignettes, but mainly I concentrated on my magnum opus, a short story called Arnold. A bald, bearded psychiatrist named Arnold is hanging out one day with a slightly depressed young female writer and her slightly depressed younger brother. Arnold gives them all sorts of helpful psychological advice, but then, at the end, gives up, gets down on his haunches, and waddles around quacking like a duck to amuse them. This is a theme I have always loved, where a couple of totally hopeless cases run into someone, like a clown or a foreigner, who gives them a little spin for a while and who says, in effect, "I'm lost too, but look, I know how to catch rabbits." It was a terrible story. I wrote a lot of other things, too. I took notes on the people around me, in my town, in my family, in my memory. I took notes on my own state of mind, my grandiosity, the low self-esteem. I wrote down the funny stuff I overheard. I learned to be like a ship's rat, veined ears trembling, and I learned to scribble it all down. But mostly, I worked on my short story, Arnold. Every few months, I would send it to my father's agent in New York, Elizabeth McKee. "Well," she'd write back, "it's really coming along now." I did this for several years. I wanted to be published so badly. I heard a preacher say recently that hope is a revolutionary patience. Let me add that so is being a writer. Hope begins in the dark, the stubborn hope that if you just show up and try to do the right thing, the dawn will come. You wait and watch and work. You don't give up. I didn't give up, largely because of my father's faith in me. And then, unfortunately, when I was 23, I suddenly had a story to tell. My father was diagnosed with brain cancer. He and my brothers and I were devastated, but somehow we managed, just barely, to keep our heads above water. My father told me to pay attention and to take notes. "You tell your version," he said, "and I'm going to tell mine." I began to write about what my father was going through, and then began to shape these writings into connected short stories. I wove in all the vignettes and snippets I'd been working on in the year before Dad's diagnosis, and came up with 5 chapters that sort of hung together. My father, who was too sick to write his own rendition, loved them, and had me ship them off to Elizabeth, our agent. And then I waited and waited and waited, growing old and withered in the course of a month. But I think she must have read them in a state of near euphoria, thrilled to find herself not reading Arnold. She is not a religious woman by any stretch, but I always picture her clutching those stories to her chest, eyes closed, swaying slightly, moaning, "Thank you, Lord." So she sent them around New York, and Viking made us an offer. And thus the process began. The book came out when I was 26, when my father had been dead for a year. God, I had a book published. It was everything I'd ever dreamed of. And I had reached nirvana, right? Well, I believed, before I sold my first book, that publication would be instantly and automatically gratifying, an affirming and romantic experience, a Hallmark commercial where one runs and leaps in slow motion across a meadow filled with wildflowers into the arms of acclaim and self-esteem. This did not happen for me. The months before a book comes out of the chute are, for most writers, right up there with the worst life has to offer. Pretty much like the first 20 minutes of Apocalypse Now, with Martin Sheen in the motel room in Saigon totally decompensating. The waiting and the fantasies, both happy and grim, wear you down. Plus, there is the matter of the early reviews that come out about 2 months before publication. The first 2 notices I got on this tender book I'd written about my dying, now dead father said that my book was a total waste of time, a boring, sentimental, self-indulgent sack of spider puke. This is not verbatim. I was a little edgy for the next 6 weeks, as you can imagine. I had lots and lots of drinks every night, and told lots of strangers at the bar about how my dad had died and I'd written this book about it and how the early reviewers had criticized it, and then I'd start to cry and need a few more drinks, and then I'd end up telling them about this great dog we'd had named Llewellyn who had to be put to sleep when I was 12, which still made me so sad even to think about. I'd tell my audience that it was all I could do not to go into the restroom and blow my brains out. Then the book came out. I got some terrific reviews in important places and a few bad ones. There were a few book signing parties, a few interviews, and a number of important people claimed to love it. But overall, it seemed that I was not, in fact, going to be taking early retirement. I had secretly believed that trumpets would blare, major reviewers would proclaim that not since Moby Dick had an American novel so captured life in all of its dizzying complexity. And this is what I thought when my second book came out, and my third, and my fourth, and my fifth. And each time, I was wrong. But I still encourage anyone who feels at all compelled to write to do so. I just try to warn people who hope to get published that publication is not all that it is cracked up to be. But writing is. Writing has so much to give, so much to teach, so many surprises. That thing you had to force yourself to do, the actual act of writing, turns out to be the best part. It's like discovering that while you thought you needed the tea ceremony for the caffeine, what you really needed was the tea ceremony. The act of writing turns out to be its own reward. I've managed to get some work done nearly every day of my adult life without impressive financial success. Yet I would do it all over again in a hot second, mistakes and doldrums and breakdowns and all. Sometimes I could not tell you exactly why, especially when it feels pointless and pitiful, like Sisyphus with cash flow problems. Other days, though, my writing is like a person to me. The person who, after all these years, still makes sense to me. It reminds me of The Wild Rose, a poem Wendell Berry wrote for his wife. Sometimes hidden from me, in daily custom and in trust, so that I live by you unaware, as by the beating of my heart. Suddenly you flare in my sight, a wild rose blooming at the edge of thicket, grace and light where yesterday was only shade. And once again I am blessed, choosing again what I chose before. Ever since I was a little kid, I've thought that there was something noble and mysterious about writing, about the people who could do it well, who could create a world as if they were little gods or sorcerers. All my life, I've felt that there was something magical about people who could get into other people's minds and skin, who could take people like me out of ourselves and then take us back to ourselves. And you know what? I still do. So now I teach. This just sort of happened. Someone offered me a gig teaching a writing workshop about 10 years ago, and I've been teaching writing classes ever since. But you can't teach writing, people tell me, and I say, who the hell are you, God's dean of admissions? If people show up in one of my classes and want to learn to write or to write better, I can tell them everything that has helped me along the way and what it's like for me on a daily basis. I can teach them little things that may not be in any of the great books on writing. For instance, I'm not sure if anyone else has mentioned that December is traditionally a bad month for writing. It is a month of Mondays. Mondays are not good writing days. One has had all that freedom over the weekend, all that authenticity, all those dreamy dreams, and then your angry, mute, Slavic Uncle Monday arrives and it's time to sit down at your desk. So I would simply recommend to the people in my workshops that they never start a large writing project on any Monday in December. Why set yourself up for failure? Interviewers ask famous writers why they write, and it was, if I remember correctly, the poet John Ashbery who answered, because I want to. Flannery O'Connor answered, because I'm good at it. And when the occasional interviewer asks me, I quote them both. Then I add that other than writing, I'm completely unemployable. But really, secretly, when I'm not being smart alecky, it's because I want to. And I'm good at it. I always mention a scene from the movie Chariots of Fire, in which, as I remember it, the Scottish runner, Eric Little, who is the hero, is walking along with his missionary sister on a gorgeous heathery hillside in Scotland. She is nagging him to give up training for the Olympics and to get back to doing his missionary work at their church's mission in China. And he replies that he wants to go to China because he feels it is God's will for him, but that first he is going to train with all of his heart because God also made him very, very fast. So God made some of us fast in this area of working with words, and he gave us the gift of loving to read with the same kind of passion with which we love nature. My students at the writing workshops have this gift of loving to read, and some of them are really fast, really good with words, and some of them aren't really fast and don't write all that well, but they still love good writing, and they just want to write. And I say, hey, that is good enough for me. Come on down. So, I tell them what it will be like for me at the desk the next morning when I sit down to work, with a few ideas and a lot of blank paper, with hideous conceit and low self-esteem in equal measure, fingers poised on the keyboard. I tell them they'll want to be really good right off, and they may not be. But they might be good someday if they just keep the faith and keep practicing. And they may even go from wanting to have written something to just wanting to be writing, wanting to be working on something, like they'd want to be playing the piano or tennis, because writing brings with it so much joy, so much challenge. It is work and play together. When they are working on their books or stories, their heads will spin with ideas and invention. They'll see the world through new eyes. Everything they see and hear and learn will become grist for the mill. At cocktail parties or in line at the post office, they will be gleaning small moments and overheard expressions. They'll sneak away to scribble these things down. They will have days at the desk of frantic boredom, of angry hopelessness, of wanting to quit forever, and there will be days when it feels like they have caught and are riding a wave. And then I tell my students that the odds of their getting published and of it bringing them financial security, peace of mind, and even joy are probably not that great. Ruin, hysteria, bad skin, unsightly tics, ugly financial problems, maybe, but probably not peace of mind. I tell them that I think they ought to write anyway, but I try to make sure they understand that writing, and even getting good at it, and having books and stories and articles published, will not open the doors that most of them hope for. It will not make them well. It will not give them the feeling that the world has finally validated their parking tickets, that they have, in fact, finally arrived. My writer friends, and they are legion, do not go around beaming with quiet feelings of contentment. Most of them go around with haunted, abused, surprised looks on their faces, like lab dogs on whom very personal deodorant sprays have been tested. My students do not want to hear this, nor do they want to hear that it wasn't until my fourth book came out that I stopped being a starving artist. They do not want to hear that most of them probably won't get published, and that even fewer will make enough to live on. But their fantasy of what it means to be published has very little to do with reality. So, I tell them about my 4-year-old son, Sam, who goes to a little Christian preschool where he recently learned the story of Thanksgiving. A friend of his, who is also named Sam, but who is 12 years old and very political, asked my Sam to tell him everything he knew about the holiday. So my Sam told him this lovely Christian preschool version of Thanksgiving with the pilgrims and the Native Americans and lots of lovely food and feelings, at which point Big Sam turned to me and said somewhat bitterly, "I guess he hasn't heard about the smallpox-infected blankets yet." Now, maybe we weren't handing out those blankets yet. Maybe we were still on our good behavior. But the point is that my students, who so want to be published, have not yet heard about the smallpox-infected blankets of getting published. So that's one of the things I tell them. But I also tell them that sometimes when my writer friends are working, they feel better and more alive than they do at any other time. And sometimes when they are writing well, they feel that they are living up to something. It is as if the right words, the true words, are already inside them, and they just want to help them get out. Writing this way is a little like milking a cow. The milk is so rich and delicious, and the cow is so glad you did it. I want the people who come to my classes to have this feeling, too. So I tell them everything I've been thinking or talking about lately that has helped me get my work done. There are some quotes and examples from other writers that have inspired me, and that I hand out every session. There are some things my friends remind me of when I call them. Worried, bored, discouraged, and trying to scrounge together cab fare to the bridge. What follows in this book is what I've learned along the way, what I pass along to each new batch of students. This is not like other writing books, some of which are terrific. It's more personal, more like my classes. As of today, here is almost every single thing I know about writing. Part 1. Writing. Getting started. The very first thing I tell my new students on the first day of a workshop is that good writing is about telling the truth. We are a species that needs and wants to understand who we are. Sheep lice do not seem to share this longing, which is one reason they write so very little. But we do. We have so much we want to say and figure out. Year after year, my students are bursting with stories to tell, and they start writing projects with excitement and maybe even joy. Finally, their voices will be heard, and they're going to get to devote themselves to this one thing they've longed to do since childhood. But after a few days at the desk, telling the truth in an interesting way turns out to be about as easy and pleasurable as bathing a cat. Some lose faith. Their sense of self and story shatters and crumbles to the ground. Historically, they show up for the first day of the workshop looking like bright, goofy ducklings who will follow me anywhere, but by the time the second class rolls around, they look at me as if the engagement is definitely off. "I don't even know where to start," one will wail. "Start with your childhood," I tell them. "Plug your nose and jump in and write down all your memories as truthfully as you can." Flannery O'Connor said that anyone who survived childhood has enough material to write for the rest of his or her life. Maybe your childhood was grim and horrible, but grim and horrible is okay if it is well done. Don't worry about doing it well yet, though. Just start getting it down. Now, the amount of material may be so overwhelming that it can make your brain freeze. When I had been writing food reviews for a number of years, there were so many restaurants and individual dishes in my brain pan that when people asked for a recommendation, I couldn't think of a single restaurant where I'd ever actually eaten. But if the person could narrow it down to, say, Indian, I might remember one lavish Indian palace where my date had asked the waiter for the Rudyard Kipling sampler and later for the Holy Cow Tartare. Then a number of memories would come to mind of other dates and other Indian restaurants. So, you might start by writing down every single thing you can remember from your first few years in school. Start with kindergarten. Try to get the words and memories down as they occur to you. Don't worry if what you write is no good, because no one is going to see it. Move on to first grade, to second, to third. Who were your teachers, your classmates? What did you wear? Who and what were you jealous of? Now, branch out a little. Did your family take vacations during those years? Get those down on paper. Do you remember how much more presentable everybody else's family looked? Do you remember how, when you'd be floating around in an inner tube on a river, your own family would have lost the little cap that screws over the airflow valve, so every time you got in and out of the inner tube, you'd scratch new welts in your thighs? And how other families never lost the caps? If this doesn't pan out, or if it does but you finish mining this particular vein, see if focusing on holidays and big events helps you recollect your life as it was. Write down everything you can remember about every birthday or Christmas or Seder or Easter or whatever, every relative who was there. Write down all the stuff you swore you'd never tell another soul. What can you recall about your birthday parties? The disasters? The days of grace? Your relatives' faces lit up by birthday candles? Scratch around for details. What people ate, listened to, wore. Those terrible petaled swim caps, the men's awful trunks, the cocktail dress your voluptuous aunt wore that was so slinky she practically needed the jaws of life to get out of it. Write about the women's curlers with the bristles inside, the garters your father and uncles used to hold up their dress socks, your grandfather's hats, your cousin's perfect brownie uniforms, and how your own looked like it had just been hatched. Describe the trench coats and stoles and car coats, what they revealed and what they covered up. See if you can remember what you were given that Christmas when you were 10 and how it made you feel inside. Write down what the grown-ups said and did after they'd had a couple of dozen drinks. especially that one 4th of July when your father made fish house punch and the adults practically had to crawl from room to room. Remember that you own what happened to you. If your childhood was less than ideal, you may have been raised thinking that if you told the truth about what really went on in your family, a long, bony, white finger would emerge from a cloud and point at you while a chilling voice thundered, "We told you not to tell." But that was then. Just put down on paper everything you can remember now about your parents and siblings and relatives and neighbors, and we will deal with libel later on. But how, my students ask? How do you actually do it? You sit down, I say. You try to sit down at approximately the same time every day. This is how you train your unconscious to kick in for you creatively. So you sit down at, say, 9 every morning or 10 every night. You put a piece of paper in the typewriter, or you turn on your computer and bring up the right file, and then you stare at it for an hour or so. You begin rocking, just a little at first, and then like a huge autistic child. You look at the ceiling and over at the clock, yawn, and stare at the paper again. Then, with your fingers poised on the keyboard, you squint at an image that is forming in your mind, a scene, a locale, a character, whatever, and you try to quiet your mind so you can hear what that landscape or character has to say above the other voices in your mind. The other voices are banshees and drunken monkeys. They are the voices of anxiety, judgment, doom, guilt, also severe hypochondria. There may be a Nurse Ratched-like listing of things that must be done right this moment, foods that must come out of the freezer, appointments that must be canceled or made, hairs that must be tweezed. But you hold an imaginary gun to your head and make yourself stay at the desk. There is vague pain at the base of your neck. It crosses your mind that you have meningitis. Then the phone rings, and you look up at the ceiling with fury. Summon every ounce of noblesse oblige, and answer the call politely with maybe just the merest hint of irritation. The caller asks if you're working, and you say, yeah, because you are. Yet, somehow, in the face of all this, you clear a space for the writing voice, hacking away at the others with machetes, and you begin to compose sentences. You begin to string words together like beads to tell a story. You are desperate to communicate, to edify or entertain, to preserve moments of grace or joy or transcendence, to make real or imagined events come alive. But you cannot will this to happen. It is a matter of persistence and faith and hard work. So you might as well just go ahead and get started. I wish I had a secret I could let you in on. Some formula my father passed on to me in a whisper just before he died. Some code word that has enabled me to sit at my desk and land flights of creative inspiration like an air traffic controller. But I don't. All I know is that the process is pretty much the same for almost everyone I know. The good news is that some days it feels like you just have to keep getting out of your own way so that whatever it is that wants to be written can use you to write it. It's a little like when you have something difficult to discuss with someone, and as you go to do it, you hope and pray that the right words will come if only you show up and make a stab at it. And often the right words do come, and you, well, write for a while. You put a lot of thoughts down on paper. But the bad news is that if you're at all like me, you'll probably read over what you've written and spend the rest of the day obsessing and praying that you do not die before you can completely rewrite or destroy what you have written, lest the eagerly waiting world learn how bad your first drafts are. The obsessing may keep you awake, or the self-loathing may cause you to fall into a narcoleptic coma before dinner. But let's just say that you do fall asleep at a normal hour. Then the odds are that you will wake up at 4 in the morning having dreamed that you have died. Death turns out to feel much more frantic than you had imagined. Typically, you'll try to comfort yourself by thinking about the day's work. The day's excrementitious work. You may experience a jittery form of existential dread, considering the absolute meaninglessness of life and the fact that no one has ever really loved you. You may find yourself consumed with a free-floating shame and a hopelessness about your work and the realization that you will have to throw out everything you've done so far and start from scratch. But you will not be able to do so because you suddenly understand that you are completely riddled with cancer. And then the miracle happens. The sun comes up again. So you get up and do your morning things, and one thing leads to another, and eventually at 9, you find yourself back at the desk, staring blankly at the pages you filled yesterday. And there, on page 4, is a paragraph with all sorts of life in it. Smells and sounds and voices and colors and even a moment of dialogue that makes you say to yourself very, very softly, You look up and stare out the window again, but this time you are drumming your fingers on the desk. And you don't care about those first 3 pages. Those you will throw out. Those you needed to write to get to that 4th page. To get to that one long paragraph that was what you had in mind when you started, only you didn't know that, couldn't know that, until you got to it. And the story begins to materialize. And another thing is happening, which is that you are learning that you aren't writing, and this is helping you to find out what you are writing. Think of a fine painter attempting to capture an inner vision, beginning with one corner of the canvas, painting what he thinks should be there, not quite pulling it off, covering it over with white paint and trying again, each time finding out what his painting isn't, until finally he finds out what it is. And when you do find out what one corner of your vision is, you're off and running. And it really is like running. It always reminds me of the last lines of Rabbit Run. His heels hitting heavily on the pavement at first, but with an effortless gathering out of a kind of sweet panic, growing lighter and quicker and quieter, he runs. Ah, runs. Runs. I wish I felt that kind of inspiration more often. I almost never do. All I know is that if I sit there long enough, something will happen. My students stare at me for a moment. "How do we find an agent?" they ask. I sigh. When you are ready, there are books that list agents. You can select a few names and write to them and ask if they would like to take a look at your work. Mostly, they will not want to. But if you are really good and very persistent, someone eventually will read your material and take you on. I can almost promise you this. However, in the meantime, we are going to concentrate on writing itself, on how to become a better writer, because, for one thing, becoming a better writer is going to help you become a better reader, and that is the real payoff. But my students don't believe me. They want agents and to be published, and they also want refunds. Almost all of them have been writing at least for a little while, some of them all their lives. Many of them have been told over the years that they are quite good, and they want to know why they feel so crazy when they sit down to work, why they have these wonderful ideas, and then they sit down and write one sentence and see with horror that it is a bad one, and then every major form of mental illness from which they suffer surfaces, leaping out of the water like trout, the delusions, hypochondria, the grandiosity, the self-loathing, the inability to track one thought to completion, even the hand-washing fixation, the Howard Hughes germ phobias, and especially the paranoia. You can be defeated and disoriented by all these feelings, I tell them. Or you can see the paranoia, for instance, as wonderful material. You can use it as the raw clay that you pull out of the river. Surely one of your characters is riddled with it, and so in giving that person this particular quality, you get to use it, shape it into something true and funny or frightening. I read them a poem by Philip Lopate that someone once sent me that goes, "We who are your closest friends feel the time has come to tell you that every Thursday we have been meeting as a group to devise ways to keep you in perpetual uncertainty, frustration, discontent, and torture, by neither loving you as much as you want nor cutting you adrift. Your analyst is in on it, plus your boyfriend and your ex-husband, and we have pledged to disappoint you as long as you need us. In announcing our association, we realize we have placed in your hands a possible antidote against uncertainty, indeed against ourselves, but since our Thursday nights have brought us to a community of purpose, rare in itself, with you as the natural center, We feel hopeful you will continue to make unreasonable demands for affection, if not as a consequence of your disastrous personality, then for the good of the collective. They stare at me like the cast of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Only about three of them think this poem is funny or even a good example of someone taking his own paranoia and shaping it into something artistic and true. A few people look haunted. The ones who most want to be published just think I'm an extremely angry person. Some of them look emotionally broken. Some look at me with actual disgust, as if I am standing there naked under fluorescent lights. Finally, someone will raise his or her hand. Can you send your manuscript directly to a publisher, or do you really need an agent? After a moment or so, I say, you really need an agent. The problem that comes up over and over again is that these people want to be published. They kind of want to write, but they really want to be published. You'll never get to where you want to be that way, I tell them. There is a door we all want to walk through, and writing can help you find it and open it. Writing can give you what having a baby can give you. It can get you to start paying attention, can help you soften, can wake you up. But publishing won't do any of those things. You'll never get in that way. My son, Sam, at 3 and a half, had these keys to a set of plastic handcuffs, and one morning he intentionally locked himself out of the house. I was sitting on the couch reading the newspaper when I heard him stick his plastic keys into the doorknob and try to open the door. Then I heard him say, "Oh, shit." My whole face widened, like the guy in Edvard Munch's Scream. After a moment, I got up and opened the front door. "Honey," I said, "what'd you just say?" "I said, oh, shit," he said. "But, honey, that's a naughty word. Both of us have absolutely got to stop using it, okay?" He hung his head for a moment, nodded, and said, "Okay, Mom." Then he leaned forward and said confidentially, "But I'll tell you why I said shit." I said, "Okay." And he said, "Because of the fucking keys." Fantasy keys won't get you in. Almost every single thing you hope publication will do for you is a fantasy, a hologram. It's the eagle on your credit card that only seems to soar. What's real is that if you do your scales every day, if you slowly try harder and harder pieces, if you listen to great musicians play music you love, you'll get better. At times when you're working, you'll sit there feeling hungover and bored, and you may or may not be able to pull yourself up out of it that day. But it is fantasy to think that successful writers do not have these bored, defeated hours, these hours of deep insecurity when one feels as small and jumpy as a water bug. They do. But they also often feel a great sense of amazement that they get to write, and they know that this is what they want to do for the rest of their lives. And so if one of your heart's deepest longings is to write, there are ways to get your work done, and a number of reasons why it is important to do so. "And what are those reasons again?" my students ask. Because for some of us, books are as important as almost anything else on earth. What a miracle it is that out of these small, flat, rigid squares of paper unfolds world after world after world. Worlds that sing to you, comfort and quiet or excite you. Books help us understand who we are and how we are to behave. They show us what community and friendship mean. They show us how to live and die. They are full of all the things that you don't get in real life. Wonderful lyrical language, for instance, right off the bat, and quality of attention. We may notice amazing details during the course of a day, but we rarely let ourselves stop and really